Are you ready?
Yeah.
Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
To this sixth seminar on basically on the self in Jung psychology. First of all, thanks to Kathy for her hospitality. And thanks to Kathy and Jane for steering the board of the Friends of Jung, and Patty's here in the board, Kathy's,
Barbara.
Kathy and Barbara. Oh, I know you guys do a lot of work, so I did say Patty. And Brooks, who does our website.
Okay, that's how
you met
yourself.
It's very soft.
But it's just enough that...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. No. It was beautiful when we were chatting.
The... the theme has been the various roads to the self, in Jung's view. We started off with the hero myth. And that was written while Jung was still a Freudian. The basic idea in the hero myth is that the hero, as a model of the ego, defeats the destructive aspect of the unconscious and connects up with the positive and guiding aspect of the unconscious and is led through the resolution of his or her difficulty. But after Jung went down into his own whale and surfaced, he realized that was a little too easy, because the unconscious doesn't automatically become a source of guidance. The ego has to maintain certain conditions for that to happen. And that's what we've been looking at, the various models that Jung turned to for understanding the ego's role in turning the unconscious into a positive and guiding force. First model we talked about was alchemy. And there the ego's job was to see, recognize, take responsibility for, acknowledge, come to terms with opposites within the personality. And when the ego could face the opposites and live their incompatibility consciously, the unconscious became creative, began producing images that resolved that conflict and would guide the ego into a more cohesive stance in life. Jung's is Mysterium Quinquionis. Okay. Ettinger's is Mysterium Lectures. The next image Jung worked with and that we talked about is Ion, and Ettinger's guide, the Ion Lectures, in which the model Jung turned to was Gnosticism, where, again, I won't go through all of it, but to make a long story short, the ego had to withdraw projections. And there was also the idea contained in that the objects in our life that we withdraw projections from come in a meaningful way. So that by looking at the various complications in your life and asking yourself how they fit into a larger pattern, and by seeing what part of yourself you project into these people in these situations, you pull back the various parts of yourself you've disowned, you actually create the self, or you reassemble the self, and then that enterprise of withdrawing projections and recreating the self allows it to become a force for guidance and growth. Last time we talked about the book of Job, and that is quite different from the other angles. The book there is Answer to Job for Jung, and the study guide is, I think it's called Transformation of the God Image. The ego is actually attacked by the self to begin with. And it's representative of the state of somebody who has often I'm tempted to say always, but that's a dangerous word in this field, often the victim of abuse or evil. Child abuse, rape, attempted murder, robbery, war, where an innocent victim has been subjected to brutality and evil. The self seems to carry that negativity, and the art of working with the self in this way is knowing how to maintain your innocence but stay in touch with the destructive appearing element of the self until that self transforms. That's putting it way too simply, but just to touch on the main points. Today we're talking about Eros, the role of erotic desire in activating the self. Our last one will be, we'll do one more in this series, which will be, I think we agreed on September 13th. We'll talk about synchronicity, because during this process of working with the self, synchronicity very often plays a very big role. So, but today we're just going to focus on the role of erotic desire. To be pure, I should say the role of Eros. I don't really want to get into all the complications of that word, because this is just try to wade into the material. But you could say by Eros, I mean anything from the crudest sexual impulsiveness to a love and treasuring that carries with it a feeling of warmth and connectedness. So anywhere from primitive instinctual love to mature, non-instinctually based love. For most of us mere human beings, we're somewhere in the middle. And so you could say, for all practical purposes, the way most of us are going to experience this is through erotic desire. Realizing that that word can have a variety of intensities and levels. So today's task is to look at the role that erotic desires play in the therapeutic situation. You're going to see how Jung gives a response to Freud's understanding of the role of erotic desire in the therapeutic situation, because Freud thought it was regressive. He thought that what these feelings mean when they come up in the therapeutic situation is you're replaying your unresolved love for your parents vis-a-vis the therapist with a sexual overtone. For Jung, that can be, of course. Jung never says Freud is wrong. It's just that doesn't fit all of the situations. Jung's response is that these feelings are signals that the healing aspect of the self is trying to enter into the therapeutic relationship. The trick is, how do you handle it? And by the way, this is a seminar, so if you have questions, stop me, unless we have a raving extrovert that I have to sit on.
I just have one quick question.
Yeah.
When I was reading Jung, if he seemed to be saying that all transference has its base in incestuous infantile fantasy.
Jung?
Yeah.
No.
In the introductory part.
No.
I didn't think that's what I thought. No, but then when I was reading what he was saying, he seemed to be saying it could all be traced back to.
You could say it could be traced back to the incest archetype.
Mm-hmm.
But the incest archetype doesn't necessarily mean parental regressive experiences. We'll see that the transference desire, Eros, does touch on the incest archetype, but not as a regressive phenomenon, but as a progressive phenomenon. And we'll talk about that. Yeah, incest and transference, incest and this Eros situation are very closely related. The question is, how do you understand it? Now, the way I figured I'd try to structure this today is to try to give you an example of a relationship I had with a client with whom there were very strong sexual feelings on both sides. And I brought along her dreams. And I thought I would start off going through, I don't know how many I brought, maybe 10 or 15 dreams that she had over the course of about this, I think these occurred over a period of about 3.5 years. We worked together probably, I don't know exactly, about 8 years, I think, total. And in these first years, the presenting issue, which was anorexia nervosa, was resolved through the erotic situation. So I thought, first I just let you hear the dreams. And I'm not really going to comment on them. I'll make one or two comments on each one. Then we'll go through Jung's working on the psychology of the transference, where he tries to lay out his understanding of this stuff. That will be the bulk of the day. And then at the end of the day, we'll come back and we'll look through the dreams again with you having heard Jung's work on the symbolism that's likely to occur during these transference phenomena. So if you go to your study guide, I'm just going to go through these dreams, touching on the basic images and the very basic pattern. This transference stuff seems to go in 9-month cycles. It's really interesting that it is really about an inner psychological birth, and the inner psychological birth seems to have the same rhythm as the real gestation of a human birth. So I'm picking up our work about 9 months after we began. So it's the beginning of the second phase of our work. I meet a fat woman, ugly, witchy. I'm afraid of her, and she knows it and keeps laughing at me. I don't like her since she has only derision for my superiority, thinness. At this time, the client weighed about 70 pounds. The last person she saw wanted to hospitalize her. And she came to me saying, "Can you keep me out of the hospital?" She keeps grabbing at my hands, laughing because mine are cold, hers are hot. I feel disgusted by the touch of her flesh. She starts to chant, "Become like us." And then I notice there is a group of women, all fat, all chanting, "Become like us." Suddenly a male figure burst forth from the sun, carrying two swords. He is dressed like a Viking, wearing breastplate, helmet, and short, hairy tunic. He is angry, vengeful, and begins hacking one breast from each woman, using the swords simultaneously so that he is mutilating two women at a time. I think you can see some obvious features of anorexia in there. The thinness versus the pull towards obesity. An anorexic always has an obese shadow. And the vicious state of the inner masculine. And the opposites, of course, the fat woman and the killer man. It's about the only dream I brought of that killer man. He showed up in two ways. Sometimes as a hacker, and sometimes as a Nazi. I say that because he's going to come back at the end.
Why is masculine
so angry? Why is masculine? Because
he doesn't have, it isn't living in her life. What makes that
masculine? That question does deserve an answer, but really, when we're working with transference in a prospective fashion, we don't ask why questions. Still, there is a why, and I mean, I think there are several whys. One, you could say, from parental experience. She herself was abused. She had a psychotic mother and was repeatedly molested, I think, by an uncle. That's one answer. Another answer is the anorexics, eating disordered women, are generally totally identified with the patriarchy. So the rejection of the feminine means identification with the masculine. This is what, of course, Marian has worked on to a great extent. But again, I think, you know, it's a valid question and it deserves a valid answer. But the way we work with this now is that these elements are going to be components of a conjunctio. And the question isn't where they came from, it's how do you get them going where they need to be. So where Freud's understanding of this sort of thing is causal, and again, you certainly can and probably even should make an argument as to their origin, but when the self is involved, we shift our perspective and we don't ask where from but where to questions. So what we'll be looking at now is where is this duality going to go? How is she going to solve this? Because in a way, each piece of that conflict has something the other needs. The fat women need some of that man's logos, and that man needs some of those women's desire.
Gary, are you differentiating between the fat woman and she just an observer? Is she a component of that whole woman group?
No, I would see the dreamer as the anorexic thin woman as an ego looking at these two pieces.
Okay.
Yeah. You could say in a way that the fat woman is her shadow.
So it's that balance between.
But again, remember we're just using one model, but when we're working in this model, we're just looking at the interaction of the two conflicted pieces. So the idea then is, you see, here is an impossible situation. And the eros between her and myself then comes in to begin synthesizing these two. So that eros is the medium of the synthesis. That's the new ingredient here. And eros, unless your Mother Teresa is going to hit you as sex. 6 months later, she wrote a poem. She called it Transference Resistance. I don't want to feel anything. The little bars just mean lines. I don't want to feel anything for you. Draw back your magic fingers. Don't give me pain, goddammit. Goddamn you. You giving me the worst task yet. Humiliator, channel my sexy mind to you, keeping my body to itself. Open and close, a fucking paradox. I won't say it's driving me to drink. So she was beginning to feel erotic feelings at that point and was saying, well, to me, but I'm anorexic, and you know anorexics split feelings in the body. You really should sleep with me, because that would heal my anorexia. And I said, well, I don't think it's going to work that way. And she had a sense of humor about it, but at that point, she really wanted to concretize those sexual feelings. And so did I, by response. Now, the unconscious, you see, begins reacting to that eros, and the dreams we will see are a response from the unconscious to that state of mind of desire. G. Sparks is, so this is a week later, G. Sparks is seated at the dining room table of a very austere formal room. The air here contains no oxygen, but he appears to be breathing normally. On the table in front of him is a covered dish, small, made of silver, and as he lifts the lid, begins to dine, I feel that I am being consumed. Just a couple of things to notice, as I say, we'll come back and look at these again. No air, so no spirit. The spiritual is going to be a force that we see as equal to the instinctual. More about that. This theme of being consumed, we'll see in the pictures as the importance of being dissolved. Of course, that's very threatening. To lose your own standpoint and be submerged in confusion.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Does it help you at all to know her narrative? Is she married?
She's married, 35, two kids. I'm just trying to keep it simple, what facts are relevant. The interesting thing was her husband, of course, scapegoated her as the problem in the family. If she just weren't anorexic, things would be fine. Well, as her anorexia resolved and she turned into a voluptuous woman, he went crazy. Yeah, he ended up nuts.
Leaving literally?
Yeah. He basically turned into a psychopath. And she had to get her kids away from him. I don't think she went to court. I think he realized that he just turned into a pot-smoking guy who sat around all day. That's all he did, smoke pot and collected on him. I think he might have even got on disability. Mm-hmm. He just totally fell apart. But she was carrying his craziness. That was part of it. She had a bachelor's, and he may have had like an MBA or something. He was in business. I don't know. I think he was at a managerial level. Other than that, I don't think the biographical details played that much of a role. Yeah, but yeah, she was married. And not happily, of course. Then she remarried. She divorced him and remarried. A month later. So you might want to keep track. We're at 7 1/4 months from the beginning of the second phase. I'm lying on the floor of an old brownstone apartment building in a large city. Where I am quartered, there is one central room, spacious, white, with a skylight ceiling and two bedrooms, one off to the left, the other off to the right of the big room. I've been reading in this middle room and am now setting up for tea. Gary is seated in a chair by a lamp. Both of us are silent. Both are dressed in white smocks, identical except that mine is floor length, while his reaches almost to the knee and is worn loose over white trousers. I am pregnant, appearing to be in my 7th or 8th month. So you see, that eros and the external relationship was the beginning of an internal pregnancy within her psyche. So a new birth is getting engendered. That, in a way, you could say in a nutshell, is Jung's view of transference, that the eros is meant to be a fertilization of the soul. And if you can handle it properly, it engenders an inner dynamic of growth, which would be the constructive aspect of the self, activated through eros consciously lived with. Couple of the details that we'll come back to. The skylight, of course, remember the Viking came from the sun. Here the skylight is less threatening. It's both a positive and a negative presence. And, of course, the pregnancy. White smocks we'll look at, too. That's important. 6 weeks later, which would be 8 months and 3 weeks from the beginning of the second phase. There's a typo. It should be my bedroom. My bedroom is totally dark. Compare that with the light earlier. My bedroom is totally dark. No candles lit. The door closed. I have a large, long, gray-haired cat, new to me. Not knowing how to be with a cat, I begin relating to her as though she were a dog. I toss a ball for her to fetch, a game she plays, but in a slightly askew way. She becomes wilder, leaping about the room, and I forget the ball and join her. In time, I realize we have begun to dance. Well, I think that cats the birth of the pregnancy. And again, just to touch on the main thing so you have some idea where we're going, that would be a sense of value and entitlement that she had not had. And it had been projected onto me. We'll talk all about that. But there is the first real positive image of her own increasing sense of value, independence, and importance. And that's what this transfer stuff is about. It is about birthing these inner strengths.
Very quick question here. Is she gaining weight at this point? Really in her physical body? Is her
yes.
At a point
because the next comment says 3 weeks later, her period resumes.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's now maybe approaching 100 pounds.
85 maybe. She was small. I mean, she was about 5 feet. So, but still, she was skin and bones.
The compulsion
didn't resolve until we get to page 2.
Okay.
But that is one thing I never talked about. I never talked about her eating. Her last therapist had her keep a list of what she was eating and throwing up. It was basically anorexia, but there was some bulimia. And I told her, you know, if you want to eat and throw up, for God's sakes, do it and enjoy it. I don't give a damn what you eat. And so she took a book of Married Women and she left it in the waiting room of the previous therapist. Because we're not seeing the anorexia, we're not seeing the eating as the problem. And she had a sense of humor, which helps. So yes, 3 weeks after the cat dream, her period returned. And yes, she was beginning to gain weight. Now I see the next dream really as a consequence of the cat dream. It's still sort of like the subsequent development of the cat confidence. But again, a very positive development, a sort of birth or a development out of her feeling that she has that cat's ability not to have to be beholding to just everything in life. In my room, the phone is ringing. I answer, and when I recognize the voice, Gary, I'm able to see his face. He's speaking very softly, the sense of it seeming that he is giving me something, yet also asking for something. His features are changing, his face gradually appearing owl-like. Now we are together in this room, his face returned to normal, kneeling before an owl. I'm not sure if G is telling me to open my eyes so that I can see it, or to watch until the owl opens its eyes. Well, again, to make a long story short, the owl would be the ability to see in the dark. In other words, she was really being able to see into her unconscious and work with it at depths, and she was able to accept the despair that was beginning to emerge that she had been covering up with her ritualistic eating. And I think again you can see here it's so clear that I was once the owl, then the owl becomes something independent. So she had projected the owl onto me, and through this erotic field that was being seen, withdrawn from me and then owned within herself. So the owl becomes her own ability to work with her dreams, where before it was something she was dependent on me for. And that would be that she's transferring her owl to me. And the again, the constructive way Jung understands that is that she is forming this relationship to me and projecting the owl onto me as a pre-stage of her beginning to be able to find the owl in herself. I think a Freudian might say she's doing that as a substitute for owning the owl, and Jung would say it's her way of experiencing the owl first externally so she can find it internally.
She's forming an image.
She's experiencing an image of something in herself on my face. Yeah. Be more accurate to say, however, not that she's forming an image, but the unconscious is forming an image on my face, which then, again, and we're working with this whole idea of purpose, the same force, let's call it, that generates the image on my face also then brings it back to her. So what we try to do is see the eros as part of this movement of things going outside and inside. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it occurs in an atmosphere of desire. Fortunate in that it rivets you two together, unfortunate if you're dumb enough to try to concretize it. You see, if you do concretize it, what happens is you've stolen the possibility of them finding the thing in themselves. So that's sort of the first phase. A third phase then starts. I have gone to bed in intense fear of dying. See the dark that the owl could see through. She's now able to experience herself. I've gone to bed in intense fear of dying during the night. Dread shakes me. I am crying for help. You enter the room, lie down beside me, holding me close to you until my shaking subsides and I drift into sleep. There you can see the sexual references starting to appear, before they were too threatening to even appear. The dream is still dark when I begin to awake, gradually aware of a sensation of a rocking motion. I seem to be in the lap of a being whose size to me is that of a mother to her newly born child. She, seated in my old shaker chair, continues rocking and gazes straight ahead into the dark. Finally, bending her head down near my face, she smiles. Again, the dark, remember how it started out light? Now we're moving into the dark where things aren't so clear. She's uncertain where she's going. She goes through great periods of loss of hope and hopelessness. And then the relationship to me, the eros that's depicted in my holding her, is one of the things that's sustaining it, that's sustaining her in that. Out of that thing between us then comes another part of herself, this woman who gazes at her and comforts her. So the protector she once saw in me, she's now seeing as a separate entity, and she's beginning to get the strength to comfort herself. Again, externalized, internalized through this medium of eros. And each of those are depicted in that dream. She calls me to comfort her. The sexual references then are holding each other as she goes to sleep. And then what she ends up with is her own ability to comfort herself, personified in that mother who looks at her, mother figure who looks at her.
The importance of when Jung says you need the other. You know,
yeah.
And she needs the other in here, the therapist, for to be holding it in this way and supporting it, and not do it for her.
Right.
In order for her to
I think at first you did do it for her. Mm-hmm. But and this is really the grace of the work. The idea is if you can hold that thing that's coming your way, the same force that pushed it your way will pull it back to her. That's Jung's optimistic threat here. You don't have to make it conscious. You have to know how to maintain the conditions that allow that process to make her conscious.
I like this mothering aspect that she brings up in life and
birth
to the newborn.
Yeah.
We hold the baby.
Right.
You know, the baby grows the best in the life the baby grows. He's still on the planet.
Yeah. See, we've had several images of what's come to her through the relationship. The cat, the owl, now the mother. Actually, I should have put that in the bold. I wanted to do that for you. The mother, and we'll see at least one or two others. Let's see. Yeah.
It's about concretizing. It's all healing based upon an energy, an energy move back and forth.
Yes.
But is it all based in the erotic or the eros?
No.
Different levels of it?
Remember, when you're dealing with transference, yes, I think it's basically eros. But there are several avenues to the self, which is why I went through the different models. This is just one avenue.
But there's all happening energy to make a healing occur, make a shift occur.
Yeah, I think so. Each of the different models we've talked about, the opposites, withdrawing projections, and being attacked, there is a very strong emotional component. With this particular model, that emotional component is largely sexual or erotic.
And it's in the transfer situation.
It's in the feelings between the therapist and the client, yeah. I have to confess, I don't like that word transference, although I use it all the time. This is a sacred thing going on. This is an I-thou experience. And yet we do use it. But to me, it just turns this into a profane process when it's really a sacred process. It makes it linear and like boxable. I mean, you can't box this thing. Anyway, I just say that. Not that we can't use that language, but I always sort of cringe. The owl, you see, is becoming humanized. Before it was an owl, and now it's a woman that looks into the dark. Gazes straight ahead into the dark. Again, we'll come back to all this stuff, but just so you can get some idea of the practical instance. 2 weeks later, as I am dressing to leave for my session with you, the phone rings. I answer and hear a voice, my stepmother, say, "Sally, your daddy..." I changed the name. "Sally, your daddy is dead." I say, "No, no, no, no. Throw the phone away and take off for your place." When I arrive, it is obvious in your face that you know, but you merely watch, observing my reaction, my denial. I admit nothing verbally, but get into the shower, knowing it is a preparation. You will tell me of his death. When I have finished, you continue your silent observation, but I realize we are leaving for the funeral. I walk into a garage to put my things in the car and see several youngish men standing near. They seem to be attendants and admire the car. As I put the bag in the trunk, it becomes my ex's old red MGA. These men wish to accompany me, and in particular, one wants to drive. I refuse, saying he has nothing to do with this. The sense is the men are sleazy. This goes a little bit to your question, Kathy. You see that this identification with the father is being broken out of the eros experience. There's more there, but that should probably do for the moment.
So basically,
starting to break down. And so that would be both her own control over her own body and her being impressed by PPFF, as Von Franck calls it, power, prestige, fame, and fortune. I don't think you can find an anorexic who's not impressed by PPFF.
Where did she learn about that? Did Von Franck talk about that?
She doesn't talk about them being attracted to BPFF. But where does she talk about BPFF? Does anyone know where she talks about BPFF? I don't remember. Prestige? Right. Power, prestige, fame, and fortune.
So people can be anorexic without food.
Well, yes. I think we live in an addictive time.
It's an addiction.
Yeah. That is, and anorexics, this is Marian's take on this thing. Anorexics are just the logical extension of our social values. They embody to a horribly intense degree what is generally moving the time.
That new book, Perfect Daughters, Perfect Girl, Starving Daughters.
Is that one of her books?
No, it's by this 28-year-old woman named Courtney. And
uh-huh.
She says her generation of women are, there's an enormous amount of anorexia and bulimia in their generation.
In
the 28-year-olds who've been raised by the liberated women, but they've been liberated into patriarchy.
That's so funny, isn't it?
And that's my language, but that's what she talks about. They've been liberated into this world of men and their suffering is terrible.
Yeah. Wow.
And the voice of it is forgotten, probably, to some extent. Mm-hmm.
They're all doing
well. Well, they're doing whatever they need to do, but they're kind of in the shadows. They're at the expectations, it seems like, of them, because they know it, they get it.
This is a hard one to disidentify from, boy. Because everything tells you you're okay if you have PPFF.
Absolutely.
And everything says you're not okay if you don't have PPFF. Okay. So 6 months later, we're now at 6.5 months after the beginning of the third phase. A luminous disk is floating in the air a short distance from the Earth. Somehow, without being conscious of it moving toward me or me toward it, I am very near, close enough to touch. The form is actually a shell, the birth of Venus, Botticelli's painting. Can you all see that? The shell opens, and I see myself contained inside. I'm lying down next to a man whom I sense is Gary. You see again the erotic. We are snuggled together as if we are awakening from sleep or settling into it. There is a strong feeling of felinity, again the cat, in me, in both of us. I feel like a cat in a gentle space. The shell continuing to float exists in two dimensions, sea and sky. I think a couple of just details to notice that we'll come back to. It's a luminous disk. So it is a testament to the numinous aspect of the feelings that she is enduring. The feminine, of course, the birth of Venus. So that the patriarchy is dying and the feminine is being born. The sea and the sky show that two domains are now being accepted. The sea as the body, and the sky is the spirit. So that she's able to work with, as we will see, both the sexual and the spiritual meaning of the feelings that are present. That's the art of it.
Well, that's where Venus came from. She was born out of Uranus's testicles that fell into the ocean.
Right.
And he was the sky god.
3 months later, so now we're at 9.5 months. Another birth, another major birth. Now with this came what I would call the resolution of her symptom. With this, she had begun eating. I would say her anorexia was largely passed. And she had gained weight. And was probably a little skinny for her body size, but not that much. I'm in an art museum where both an informal tour reception is taking place. The gallery is European, located in either Germany or Switzerland. The people in attendance are of various nationalities and social levels. The tone seems friendly, vivacious, and I, though I know no one, am quite comfortable and interested in my surroundings. I see a man, blonde, in elegant attire, who seems somehow attracted to me, to have been subtly present at any place, should be where I have lingered. On the stairway that is flooded with sunshine from a skylight ceiling, he motions me aside and asks if I will join him for a drink. We seat ourselves at a small table. His demeanor is bright, happy, very appreciative of me, hopeful of pleasing. He suggests a cognac or something I've never heard of, and I choose a cognac, warmed, which seems to delight him absurdly. He names the drink, the term unfamiliar to me, pronouncing it a good choice, I wonder. Only when I wake, Only when I wake do I fully apprehend who he is. My Nazi hacker has been transformed. That, I would say, is another birth, that transformation. How can you say that when you look at the models walking down catwalks? They're doing exactly what the patriarch wants.
Okay, so they're doing what the patriarch, but they're not actually attracting the lies. It's all on the seduction of the patriarchy, not a real man. That's right, yeah.
A fourth phase begins, and this is where we'll leave off. A year later. The oyster shell is a magnificent blue, black, gray, the eye like the eye of a peacock's tail. Peacock's tail is a very frequent image in alchemy. I lie inside, very tiny and naked, feeling very free of my fears. The shell is floating in the sky ocean, a deep, dark blue, and from the depths of this blue, a golden light streaks into the shell. I feel it encircle me, outlining the shape of my body. So, see, there the light is coming up from the ocean. It's not a solar light. It's a light from the depths. And I'm no longer present, and she's experiencing her body as a separate entity, bathed in that light. And that would indicate the growth of her own sense of independence. And her body has been reconstituted. Well, that's a series of dreams. What we'll do now, I'll take some time for questions if you want to, but we'll start looking at the series of alchemical pictures that Jung wrote up in his essay, The Psychology of the Transference, to try to understand the kinds of phenomena that we just saw here indicated in these series of dreams. Any questions in general?
Does your erotic energy match hers?
Yes.
So as she begins to adjust, that you feel your own erotic movement begin to dissipate as well.
Yeah.
But it really... She's like leading this dance, so...
Somebody's leading it.
I'll be honest. It's intriguing to know, I mean, because...
See, you said something that triggered something I wanted to say, but... Forgot already what you...
Well, did your erotic energy follow?
Oh, yes, match? Yes, thank
the
you, yes.
The dissipation of hers, did your follow?
That's a very good point. You might... wonder, how do you know what's transference and how do you know what's real love? And now I'm sort of going to contradict everything I've said, why I don't like the word transference. This, I think, is why the word transference is right. Once you understand it, it goes away like that. I remember the hour that this was resolved. We went from having to keep our hands off of each other to nothing. It changes literally in 1 second, once its meaning is understood, or if you prefer, once its purpose has been fulfilled and its meaning is understood. So the two of you are seized, and now, and this sort of thing doesn't happen very often, thank God. I've been through it just a few times, to where you say, you know, you're the one. I'm going to throw away everything I ever worked for because you're the one. What good is everything without you? and next minute, there is nothing. That's...
What are your own dreams telling you during this time? Does that help you at all to try to manage?
Yeah.
Do you pay close attention to your own
dreams? Oh, yeah. Yeah. More to be true to the intensity of the level of emotions that are being experienced. That, I think, is at least my challenge. I think it would be just about anyone's challenge. That, in a way, she is being seized. She's humiliated, you know. She's propositioned me. I've turned her down. Of course, that brings up all those feelings that you've had from adolescence, that I'm not okay. I'm supposed to be the objective one. She's the one who's suffering. And I think our job is to be as fully moved as the feelings are asking us to be moved. That's the challenge. Really, there's very little interpretation that goes on. This thing just works itself out.
Your job is to stay in it.
Your job, and really both people's jobs, is to stay aware of the feelings, to not act them out, but also not repress them, to be in that middle place, which would be like the in between the sea and the sky. The sky would be to spiritualize it and intellectualize it. You know, to go in the sea would be to literally sleep with the person, and you have to hover in between, living with the desire, but also consciously working with it at the same time.
You talk about your parent transference responses to women, and you say,
not so much. I think she knew. I mean, she could tell that I was with her.
You don't actually talk about it.
Oh, well, she knew I was.
I sure.
She felt it. Mm-hmm. How do you know when somebody's...
But you didn't speak it.
I think I probably did. I didn't harp on it. Right. Right. That is something, you know, this is what we're doing here, is looking at the really sort of the archetypal level of the work. Jung says at the beginning of Psychology of Transference, this essay is not for beginners. I'm not going to tell you how do you handle transference. I assume you know that. And one of the things you have to assess is, can the individual keep within the vessel? And she could. Sometimes people can't, and if they can't, then you can't do this. What's it mean to keep inside the vessel? Keep their mouth shut. Don't talk about what's happening here with other people. Don't set it up so that feelings that need to be worked out here suddenly get worked out someplace else, because they happen to know where you shop, and they show up where you're shopping, and they pick a fight with you in the waiting line or something like that. That's containment. Yes, it has to be able to be contained. Yeah.
This particular issue was a very significant one for the Jung group, at least, because I think all of Jungian stuff, but clearly the Jung society in Chicago in the 80s, and because they were talking about it at the conference on the shadow. And what had happened is that the number of the analysts within the group had started having relationships with their clients. And suddenly the dreams about this started showing up in other clients' stuff. And so I can't remember who, was it, I think it was Jean Shirley Bowen, spoke about this very issue publicly at the conference. And it was talking about how the whole Jungian community had to deal with this because it was happening to the whole, and because the community was so focused on the personal, they hadn't looked at how the personal began to impact the collective. Mm-hmm. So they had to start dealing with it.
Other questions? Well, let's start looking at Jung's text.
Well, I've got a question here.
Yeah.
talk about what changed in your life because of this? Because if this energy was moving, did it, in other words, how were you able to work on it for your own self?
Well, I think you can see in one of the dreams we're both waking up. The power of love. Actually, it's probably a good time to stop. It's 10:30. Shall we have a stretch? And then we'll come back, go to noon. We'll go from noon, take a break from noon to 1, and we'll finish at least by 3:30.